I have read or enjoyed nothing in the past 6 months. And then I started looking and I was like, oh yeah, that was really good.
If only we could take our love of reading to a new level.
Well, I've always wanted to start a book club. Book
club! For masochists and other deviants.
Hello and welcome to the Book Club for Masochists, where we read and discuss all the genres and types of literature, regardless of our actual interest in them.
Every month, we read books from a new, randomly picked genre. Then on the podcast, we discuss our reading choices, experiences, opinions, appeal factors, and other related topics as friends and library workers.
In this, episode number 109, we are talking about other media that we've consumed.
Unrelated to podcast reading or
yes.
Consuming.
Yes. Hey, I'm doing some podcast consuming for this episode and discussing it.
Yes.
Just not our podcast.
I've got podcasts on my list too, so. But who are we?
Oh, yeah. Details. Hello, my name is Anna. I'm a librarian in Las Vegas, Nevada, USA.
My name is Matthew. I'm a librarian in Guelph, Ontario, Canada.
Thanks for bringing down the tone.
My name is Megan. I'm an archivist in the National Capital Region of Canada.
My name's RJ. I'm a librarian in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
I was going to say that I think I was smiling so hard, like on the edge of laughing when I did the intro, that I'm pretty sure I kind of like breathed one of the words without actually saying them. So I'm pretty sure I said something like, we're read and discuss all of the genres and miss the we entirely because I was trying to hold myself in control.
I feel like we're bringing some real mixed energy into this episode.
Yeah, it's real chaotic.
The consistent thing is that we're all tired. But I think some of us are like, you know, the sort of loopy, delirious tired, and some of us are just melting.
But not from heat.
No.
Just melt, just general. Yeah. Falling apart, melt.
Announcements. This is one announcement this episode. You may have heard that I was streaming visual novels last month in August, and you may have been thinking, what's a visual novel? Well, now hopefully you've listened to the episode we did about visual novels and understand what they are. So now you might have interest in watching me play more of them. Don't worry, I won't be doing it every day, thankfully. I think everyone is thankful about that. But I will be doing them once a week, starting on Friday, September the 18th. At 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, and then they will get recorded and put on YouTube as well. It's at twitch.tv/bookclubform, and for the moment, I think I'm only going to be playing Halloween/spooky dating simulators. That's going to be my theme. Friday night, spooky dating simulators. Will I date a ghost? Will I date a vampire? Will I date a Frankenstein monster? We'll find out together. You can help decide who I date. Announcement number two. We're continuing to do our retrospective genre-based book lists by authors of color, by people of color, and we've reached nonfiction technology, which was originally our third ever genre that we've covered on the podcast. So you can go to our show notes or to our website, and you can find the list of nonfiction technology books by people of color that we've put together there. And now on to our topic for the episode.
All right, we get to talk about things that we supposedly enjoyed, so that should be good, right?
Yeah.
Woo. No, yeah, I was, at first when I thought about this, I was like, I have read or enjoyed nothing in the past 6 months. And then I started looking and I was like, oh yeah, that was really good. Oh, that was really good. Oh shoot, I have to cut this down a little. So, I appreciated that moment of, yeah, actually, I did have some fun media in the past little while, despite the whole, like, doom scrolling and the attention span of a gnat, because that happened as well.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So who wants to go first?
I will go first with one that is perhaps appropriate for our sleepiness. It's called Sleepy Princess in the Demon Castle by Kagiji Kumanomata. It's a manga series that I picked up. I can't remember if this was recommended in like a panel I saw online, or if I just, I think it must have been. Anyway, there was just a bunch of people, manga, that were like, these are the best manga of the year. And I picked this one up kind of because it was one of the few that the library had here. And it's just really cute. It's about a princess who's captured by a demon and is being held hostage in this demon castle. And every chapter, and the chapters are only like 10 pages long, is her trying to go to sleep. And she does this by like traumatizing all of the other demons that live in the castle. She like, you know, cuts up them and turns them into sheets. She like liquefies them and puts them into like a waterbed that she makes. She just causes mass death amongst them just so she can collect like honey or whatever it happens to be. It's very weird. And she's just completely oblivious to the fact that she's like kind of in terrible danger, but she's not, because the demons are all like, they kidnapped her so that the hero would come and fight them and that they could defeat the hero. But she keeps like screwing up the plan. Like they've got this, like this very complicated plan. That's like a quest, like in fantasy stories that we don't see any of, but we hear it referenced. And it's like, oh, he has to go here and get this tool, like this sword or this spell or whatever. And she's like, meanwhile, like using them to like clean sheets that she spilled juice on. And so they're like, oh no, that spell's gone now. How do we get, and the hero keeps getting lost because she keeps like screwing up what's like the quest things that he's supposed to find. So it's cute and funny.
That was a wildly more violent description than what you gave me earlier today when you're describing this thing as like something very cute that I might enjoy reading.
Like they're not dead. They come back to life. Like there's a very overworked cleric at the demon cleric who keeps bringing them back to life.
Okay.
It sounds cute and fantastical.
There's also a lot of like demon teddy bears. Yeah, it's very interesting to read this, like the very short chapters in it. And there's another one, Where the House Has Been by Kusuke Ono, which is another one which had like chapters that were a lot shorter than I was used to in manga. I can't remember exactly how long they were, but it's about like a former like Yakuza hitman who is now like a house husband. And it's kind of the opposite from this one. This one is about like a kind of cute, like innocent sort of person who's like traumatizing all these demons, whereas Way of the House Husband is about like a really scary like Yakuza guy who's like just trying to get deals at department stores and like make box lunches for his wife, but doing everything in a kind of terrifying way.
I like this.
So I think they're kind of good companion pieces. I hadn't really thought of that until now, but they're kind of two sides of the same coin in some ways. I didn't have that on one of my list originally because when we put out a post about comedic or humorous fiction, someone mentioned Way of the House Husband. I'm like, oh, I should mention that in the next episode. But instead I've talked about it now. Too late.
Oops.
You get to talk about it again.
There's no more volumes of the library, so I'll have forgotten in 2 weeks' time.
Oh. Who next?
I was going to go with podcasts because Anna reminded me, and I've got three, and one of the common threads is they're all fairly short. So Cood Street Podcast is a long-running sci-fi fantasy podcast by Jonathan Strathen and Gary K. Wolf, who are both like critic editors. But they've, since pandemic stuff, they've been releasing 10 to 20 minute interviews with authors where they talk about what they've been reading. And I love this because it's both short and you get to hear from so many different authors. Next one is The Slowdown, which is a poetry podcast, and it hits 5 minutes almost every single time. Tracy K. Smith does a little intro and then reads the piece of poetry. And then the last one is a 30-minute interviews with female runners. The podcast is called Strides Forward. And right now the season is focusing on Comrades, which is a 90-kilometer South African ultra marathon. So completely different from the last two. But again, I really like the tighter, shorter format. And I really enjoy the range of interviews that have been going on because it's from like people who had basically very little experience in running before they started to people who've done this thing for like 12 times or whatever. Why do you want to do an ultra marathon 12 times? Well, listen to a couple of the interviews and you might figure it out. So that was my first chunk of media that I've been enjoying recently.
I'm unsurprised that you're enjoying media about ultra marathons, Megan. It seems very on brand for you.
I suspected.
I mean, those selections, they were a good on-brand target. I appreciated it. I guess I'll mention the podcast that I have then that I've been listening to a lot is the, I think they actually call it Dig a History Podcast, but I just call it the Dig History Podcast. And it's for female historians, working at universities, teaching history, and also like as professionals, professionally trained. And they do pretty darn in-depth history. Like, these things are intense and quite impressive. They're fully scripted, so they're funny. Like, they comment as they go along, but they are scripted, and so you can actually go get the full transcripts from their website and all the information and their references and everything that they used to write them. They've been doing it for quite a while, but I just, wasn't listening to podcasts for a while and just discovered them recently. And I've been enjoying it a lot. They're very interesting. Some of the ones that I've found really interesting, they do series. So they'll do four in a row that play off of a single concept, but in different ways. So it could cover at one time period, but from four different angles, or it could cover one topic, but across many time periods and locations, or like very loosely cover a concept in wildly different ways. And I don't know if I should say that this is exactly the most enjoyable topic, but I found their coverage of eugenics to be incredibly interesting. One of the ones I found particularly interesting was an episode from May 12th of 2019 called Choice, Sterilization, and Eugenics in 20th Century Puerto Rico. And then another one that I found very interesting from May 24th of this year, 2020, was Steaming the Nefarious Sin, Bathhouses and Homosexuality from the Victorian Era to the AIDS Epidemic. So both of those were things that, I knew some amount, I'd heard, but this wildly expanded my understanding of these topics. And I thought they were extremely well structured and very interesting. And they have, so they always do, there's four of them, but it's always just two of them who present any given episode. So they sort of switch off between which two it is. And I kind of get their voices mixed up once in a while. I sort of have them sorted out now, but there's at least a couple of them I consistently mix up. And their episodes are usually from anywhere from 50 minutes to an hour and 15 minutes long. So they're kind of on the longer end, but very worth it and very interesting.
No, those do sound really interesting.
Yeah, they're very well done. They've been at it for a while. They apparently had a previous, before this, they did a podcast, I think called the History Buffs Podcast. But I have not listened to that one. I'm not familiar with it at all. I just came across them from the Dig Podcast, History Podcast.
Cool. Well, the first media that I'm going to talk about is a book.
What?
What?
A little off-brand for me.
For this podcast in general, really.
For these episodes. This is a book I read in August, and I really enjoyed the visual novel format in August because it did mean that I read the first adult full-length novel. Novel for adults, not like a dirty novel. The first full-length novel for adults that I've read for not the podcast in over a year. And some of that is because of I'm usually reading things for the podcast and I'm not a super fast reader. But that is also because I just haven't been doing a ton of reading in 2020 for, the usual reasons. One thing connected to that is that I haven't been traveling and I usually get a lot of reading for enjoyment done while traveling.
That's true.
That has been cut out of my life.
I really miss reading on the bus.
Mm-hmm.
On the train, on the plane, in the waiting rooms. All of the travel spaces.
Boats. Yeah. We didn't mention that one.
Boats. Definitely boats. Horseback.
I don't think I would read a lot on horseback, to be honest.
You're assuming I can afford a horse as opposed to just a good old donkey.
I'm sure you could rent a pony ride and then have someone else lead the pony while you read on the back of it. I feel like I might get motion sick, though.
Yeah, for sure.
I would spend all of my time trying not to fall off.
Yeah, you would. It's true. And your butt would get so sore.
Okay, it was a joke. I have no plans to read on horseback. What I read was a sci-fi novel called Tell the Machine Goodnight by Katie Williams. This I just picked up. I saw it at work, and you know, it had a good cover and a good title. And I read the first page and was hooked and brought it home. The plot, as it were, there's not really a plot. There is a concept, and the concept is that there is a machine in the near future that, you know, takes a sample, you know, it's a cotton swab in your mouth, takes a little sample of your genetic material, and returns to you a short list of things that will make you happier. And the very first page, someone is in for this appointment to get this advice from the machine. And the machine tells him to eat tangerines, move his desk at work near a window, and cut off an inch of his right index finger. And it's this very, like, it struck me as like this very Twilight Zone high concept sci-fi element that like communicates something about human nature and is integrated. You know, it's a very like kind of like our world with this one high concept change. And the book is sort of about a person who works for the corporation that has patented this technology, Pearl. But it's really about like Pearl and everyone in her circle, in her life, her son and her ex-husband and her ex-husband's wife and this like celebrity who comes to the clinic. And so as I was reading, I felt very strongly that each chapter, which is from like different perspectives, and it gets a little experimental about the perspectives at various points, each chapter felt a lot more like a short story, even though it was like very much not a collection of short stories. It was a novel, but each chapter sort of had its own internal self-contained plot. So there was like a new tension introduced and resolved by the end of the chapter, which made it like surprisingly satisfying to read. Like every chapter felt very good to finish. I will say the last few chapters, I think, were the weakest, which is too bad. But like the first several are very good. So I think it was sort of an odd book, but I've really enjoyed a lot of it. And I really like that sci-fi thing of, you know, just one little tweak to our world. And also the sort of fun, like, you know, you keep finding out throughout the book various people's results from this test and getting to find out what, you know, weird, quirky things people get recommended. It's like a little treat to string you along. So that was Tell the Machine Goodnight.
Yeah, I love the title. And I definitely put a hold on it.
Bingo sheet!
It says something about me that when you described what the first character is recommended to do, my immediate thought was like, how long is an inch? And I'd be like, how many centimeters is that? Like, how, like, what?
Sorry.
It's okay. It's like what the book said. And I wouldn't know in centimeters either, really.
I could be wrong. I feel like an inch is feasible, but it might have been a half inch or whatever it was.
Just that last little bit of your fingertip.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much.
I think an inch would be up to like the main knuckle, but yeah, it might have been regardless. I don't think we need to pin this down.
Unpleasant any length. Nobody has other media about cutting off parts of their body.
I think...
Nope, I did not. go down that path.
I guess I can just talk about The Way of the House Husband again, because that is referenced in that book, in that comic.
Connections.
I mean, I can sort of link it, but I feel like going around is good enough.
Are you sure nobody lost any, like, toes while doing ultramarathons?
I mean, as far as ultramarathons go, that was a pretty short one.
Oh my gosh.
My partner was just reading me a section out of a book where the person ran a, like, I think it's 236-mile course, and did it in 86 hours. And then because she had a 14-month-old at home, had to take time at each of the rest stations to express breast milk or something like that. And I'm like, this is just too hardcore for me.
So 236 miles is 380 kilometers.
Yeah.
I just don't understand.
I think there's so many parts of that that we don't understand, Anna. Yeah. It's like both having a child and running an ultramarathon are like equally incomprehensible to us.
I can talk about sort of related destroying parts of yourself so the rest of yourself can live if no one else has a burning need to go off onto their second pick.
I don't know if I want to hear you talk about that, Megan.
So my second chunk is actually a group of memoirs. And the first one I'll talk about, because it didn't include this kind of sense of killing off parts of yourself, is called The Undying by Anne Boyer. And what it is, it's a memoir, very poetically written, lots of philosophy in it, kind of in a response to Illness as a Metaphor by Susan Sontag.
I read that this year, actually. It was an interesting thing to read right now, that and the AIDS and its metaphors.
Yeah. So Anne Boyer has breast cancer. She's in the United States, and she works as like a, I want to say an adjunct, but basically that kind of precarious teaching position. And so it's a memoir of the process of taking chemotherapy, of, you know, injecting things into your body that are so toxic or poisonous, if they fall on the floor, they would burn holes through the floor, and all of this kind of thing. And it was just so well written. I think it's one of the first times I've come across a book that after I finished reading it, I wanted to like give it out to everyone that I knew. Clearly I haven't done that, because otherwise you'd all have copies and there would be so many copies everywhere. It'd be like those photographs you see sometimes of value villages or secondhand stores with their, towers of Twilight books or 50 Shades of Grey, yeah. Something like that. Anyway, so that was one of the first memoirs. The next one is In the Dream House by Carmen Maria Machado, who wrote Her Bodies and Other Parties, a collection of short stories that are like weird, creepy horror type. And this is her experience of being in an abusive lesbian relationship. And it's sort of structured around this house in a town in which the relationship largely goes on. And it's really beautifully written. It's very gothic. It really brings the house into the storytelling in this really powerful, beautiful way. I feel like it's probably gotten some press recently, but it was definitely a wonderful read and a highlight of my month. And the last one is actually my first reread in years. I have no idea how long it's been since I've done a reread, but I reread Turning, a swimming memoir. It's by Jessica J. Lee, and it's about a year in Berlin where every week she swims in a different lake. And you may think, oh, but it's in Berlin, so maybe the winter is not too bad. No, they have these wonderful descriptions of her taking her trusty hammer out into the lake so she can smash a hole into it so she can get in and swim her, like, several lengths and then swim back again. And just so you don't think it's not all about weird sufferance and endurance sports and stuff like that, she brings in this wonderful research into lakes and how lakes work. So turning is this process where as the different levels of the lake gain or lose heat, they sink and turn and shift. And so she talks a lot about the science of lakes, which has a name, which I've forgotten, as well as her particular need to do this swimming project. Because, of course, there's always human needs for strange physical feats, like I must swim 52 different lakes over 52 different weeks in a place where it gets cold enough there's ice on the water.
Limnology is the study of lakes, ponds, and stuff like that.
There we go.
What was that first one? I want to read that one.
The Undying.
I am literally on the website. Oh, wait, I have a copy of this at home.
Perfect.
Which is on my to-read shelf.
Speaking of to-read shelves, someone recently tagged us on Twitter asking to see our to-read shelves. And we tweeted out, each of us, I think, tweeted out photos of what our current to-read shelves are. So if you want to see what that looks like, it'll be in the show notes.
Stacks of books.
You can possibly see this book in one of the stacks on that in that picture, because I'm quite, it is on that, well, it's not on that shelf. It's actually sitting in front of that shelf, but it's there.
And feel free to share your to-read shelf or pile or stack or whatever it happens to be on Twitter or on Facebook or wherever it happens to be. You don't even have to tag us, honestly. Just do it. It's fun.
All right. My next thing is sad music.
So, RJ, is this music for your other podcast?
No. So this is not Christmas music. This is sad music. You know, we've all been having some times this year, and I go through phases with sad music where sometimes, I need it. I need it like oxygen. Gotta have it. And other times, it just makes me feel worse, and I can't handle it. And I'm in the latter right now. But when I was in the former space, I did make a note of that I wanted to talk about a few bands that I've been listening to a lot this year. One band and one artist. So the first one, the band, is Black Dresses.
They're great.
They are great. Yeah. I was wondering, well, I when I was making notes, I was like, I don't know that much about Matthew's taste in music, but I think he would like them. So I'm glad that you do.
I was listening to your other podcast, Hark, your holiday music podcast, earlier today. And the most recent episode, Ian described one of the tracks as discordant. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, I love discordant music. And then you were like, yeah, it's kind of like Black Dresses. I'm like, oh, I love Black Dresses. So yeah, definitely. One of my friends who introduced me to Black Dresses is like, this is the most Matthew band or group or thing that I can possibly think of. And I'm not sure how to take that, to be honest.
Yeah. I had seen their genre described as noise pop or electro-industrial.
Mm. Yeah.
So yeah, they're definitely discordant.
But catchy?
But yes, catchy. So yeah, I wrote down a bunch of just words that like as in terms of both how they sound and like themes of their lyrics. So I this year have been listening a lot to their first album, Waste Isolation. They have a few others that I should probably check out. But that is their first and most popular, I think. And the words I wrote down, yeah, were discordant, dark, alienation, isolation, terror, surreal, extremely listenable.
I would find myself just walking along singing to like Eternal Nausea out loud, mm-hmm. which is really kind of weird for me because I don't usually pay attention to lyrics in any level. And the lyrics I'm reading are just like, I feel sick, I still feel sick over and over again. I'm just like, this isn't like healthy to sing out loud. I hope nobody hears me singing this. Though at the same time, I'm the dude like dressed entirely in black. So it's probably in like, not like out of what people expect me to be saying. I feel sick. So feel sick.
So feel sick. I feel sick. On the other hand, there is like, this is one of the reasons why I really love the song Batshit from Sophie Tucker, mm-hmm. because I just love the fact that she gleefully sings the word batshit over and over and over again in that song. I just, there's something about that that makes me really happy.
I'm batshit crazy.
Batshit. Yeah. One thing I found out when I was looking up the name of the album, Waste Isolation, today to talk about it, was that I didn't realize it was recorded. So there's two members of the band, and it was recorded with them never being in the same room. Like, mm-hmm. one of them was living in Toronto and one of them was living in Vancouver, and they recorded the whole album remotely, which I think is wild for how awesome it sounds.
Definitely.
I'll finish talking about Black Dresses and then talk about the other band. I'll throw in a quick content warning if you want to go check out Black Dresses for transphobia and for sexual violence. That is, at least on Waste Isolation, there is a lot of content on those topics. And yeah, like I said, it is, you know, on some level, sad music. It is dark. But when I'm in a dark mood, it is like really good to listen to because it is dark, but like it's also like very energetic. And so for a while, it was really helping me like get through my routines to have something bouncy but dark on.
I want to clarify here that while transphobia is definitely a major topic of this music,
mm-hmm.
it is not
oh, yeah.
transphobic.
Yeah, sorry. Both members of the band are trans. So the content about transphobia is about experiencing transphobia. Yeah, their albums are all available on Bandcamp. I think they are not streaming anymore. They did disband this year, unfortunately, which is a bummer. But all of their music is still on Bandcamp. Check it out. The other artist is Mitski. Who I was gonna say is more melodic, is more like accessible in terms of sound, but I think some of her earlier albums does have some of that like discordant energy. There's some screaming happening in some of her older stuff for sure. And yeah, her overall sound is a little more subdued. I guess she does have some like bouncy, energetic tunes, but she has a lot of sad songs about loneliness and romantic longing. And I feel like there's some deeply psychological stuff about identity happening. But also just like really pleasant to listen to. So Mitski and Black Dresses, very pleasant, sad music for if that's what you need.
I don't know if I would describe Black Dresses as pleasant.
That's fair. Enjoyable.
Maybe also divisive.
Yeah, no, I don't. I do not think this is going to be everybody's thing. I think you should go check them out. But I had a note and I wasn't going to mention it, but I was thinking of the book that I read for our Bizarro Fiction episode, mm-hmm. F4 by Larissa Glasser, which is also written by a trans woman and also like very dark and surreal and inaccessible in a lot of ways, but in a way that's pretty intentional and is itself communicating something about the artist's experience, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's my sad music.
I feel like I'm going to very briefly mention a music group that you just mentioned, Anna, Sophie Tucker, who are an electronic music duo who do a stream every day at 1 p.m. Eastern on Twitch and Instagram and various places. And they just do like a DJ set every day and they play new music that's theirs and they do remixes and it's a lot of fun. And they've done it literally every day since the pandemic basically happened. Wow. So they're at like, you know, they've been doing it daily for like, I think at least 6 months at this point. I think maybe the 6 month anniversary was like last week.
My God, what is time?
Yeah, it's wild. But it's fun. I dance to it a bunch in my bedroom.
This is Sophie Tucker, S-O-F-I-T-U-K-K-E-R.
Yes, it is.
Yes. Okay. That's it.
the thing I really want to talk about is a video on YouTube that I really liked that came out last month called Anarchism and Police Abolition, featuring Domri Raid by Spice 8 Rack. And this is all about what anarchism is and why police abolition is a thing, structured in a video about Magic the Gathering lore.
What?
Spice 8 Rack is someone that has done a lot of videos about Magic the Gathering. That's how they became popular. But they're also like a radical leftist. And I really, really love that this community is being exposed to radical politics by this person. It makes me so happy that these really kind of like entertaining, interesting videos like that are explaining what anarchism is and why the anarchism that was portrayed in Magic the Gathering is not what actual political anarchy is great. I saw someone tweet something online this week, someone who should, in my opinion, should know better about what anarchism is as a political philosophy and just completely misunderstanding what it is. I'm like, you need to watch this video. That will tell you, that will give you a much better understanding of what anarchy and anarchism means and why people will follow it as a political philosophy and why it's not about chaos and not caring about other people. But It's over an hour long, but it's on YouTube, so you can watch it at faster speed. And I don't know, if you're not into Magic the Gathering, how much sense it will make, but I think it's entertaining enough to just know it's a weird fantasy world, and we're going to look at anarchism from that world. What I also really appreciate is that he literally has a stack of like books in the video that he's like, here are all the books I'm referencing, and has like all that citation reference info in like the description of the video, which is like kind of fun to see someone like not just talk about it but like back up all their stuff as well. I watched a lot of like various other videos about like anarchism and stuff after watching this one, but this is still my favorite one.
So I guess my next one I will talk about is a book called On Immunity and Inoculation by Eula Biss. And it is a book of very short chapters that walk through kind of a thought process, essentially, but tie it in with history and personal narrative and science and, public health, you know, basics of public health and stuff, and ties it all together. And it's from the perspective of a woman who is trying to explore, as she has her first child, is exploring the thought process of women who choose not to vaccinate their children. So she does choose to vaccinate her child, but she examines that whole thought process and how you end up in that space of thinking that that's the best decision to make, and in a very compassionate way, because she's really thinking through the same, she comes from a background, and you know, like a lot of the people who are susceptible to this are quite educated, right? And she's an educated white woman in the suburbs, which is kind of where a lot of this is coming from. And she walks through all of that and unpacks how you end up in that thought process. And it's just incredibly well structured and very compassionate and thoughtful, but it really pulls a lot of history of like anti-vax movements going all the way back into the 1800s in the United States, and in the UK, and just looks at how these came to be and what they're tied to that has nothing to do with science at all. But a lot of it comes down to her central thesis that when you look through the science and when you look at how public health works, what you come to understand is that our bodies are not really separate from each other, that there are so many ways in which our bodies impact and affect and depend upon each other's bodies, that there is a kind of communal health in that. A lot of it is about how you just really can't think of your body as being separated from your community, that we necessarily rely upon each other's health and are each other's health. And if you try to separate that out, which America has a very strong bent towards individualism, of course, you compromise your own health as much as other people's health, because we are all, to some degree, one body in a way. So anyways, it was very beautifully written. It was very compassionately written, but also extremely persuasive. And I enjoyed reading it quite a lot. It was a good read.
Yeah, that has some interesting impacts on the current, like, anti-mask type of rhetoric that goes
yes.
on. I've had some arguments with people who are like, I'm not scared of the virus. And I'm like, it's not about you.
It's not about you.
It's about all those other people whose immune system is just a little bit lesser. Like, anyway.
Yeah, I actually read it back in, I don't know, like June or something like that. And I wasn't even thinking about anti-mask movement or anything like that when I read it. It just, you know, it was vaguely about this topic of health in some way. And that's why I picked it up to read it, because health was on my mind. And then it was very relevant to the times without like scaring me, because yeah. it was just slightly side of what we were, you know, it's not dealing with our topic exactly, but also is extremely relevant.
No, it's a read an interesting sort of companion book, which might be more scary. It's called Doing Harm, The Truth About How Bad Medicine and Lazy Science Leave Women Dismissed, Misdiagnosed, and Sick by Maya Dissonberry.
Yeah, that's on my list.
Oh, it's just, it's terrifying to read accounts of people who go underdiagnosed. They don't get the pain medication they need unless, like, they bring their own personal white male with them to confirm their own bodily experience. And then the doctor's like, oh, okay, this is a reasonable person. But it really hit me hard, because a lot of the things the interviewees talk about doing, like either underplaying their pain or being like really retrescent to seeking out medical attention to try and avoid this narrative that women are hysteric and like somehow can't be quite believed about their own medical cases. I was like, oh yeah, I've done that. I've totally like underplayed my pain, you know, coming out of surgery and I'm crying in pain and saying, oh, it's only 6 out of 10. And the nurse is like, really? Maybe you should reevaluate that. So it's an interesting comparison for women trying to deal with medical institutions that don't necessarily always serve their needs. Or I didn't read your book, so I'm not sure how that those two play together.
Yeah, but I feel like that also plays into the one of the Dig History podcast episodes I recommended, the one that was on sterilization in Puerto Rico. That there's some similar things that are playing through in that, and actually quite a bit of the Dig History podcast deals with these sorts of topics. Like medicine comes up a lot, and women's health issues and women's you know, like your bodily autonomy and the degree to which it is recognized within your culture comes up a lot in that podcast. Not just bodily autonomy, I guess it's also like your whether or not your culture recognizes your ability to even know your body.
Yep.
Matthew's having issues over there.
Sorry, I was about to sneeze and then I just saw something stupid on Twitter.
That's real new cure for hiccups.
That's also just like, that is just like so, I don't know, the moment. So of the moment. I was going to sneeze, but then I saw something dumb on Twitter, so.
Well, you know, at least we've got things to put in the intro of this episode. I sometimes wonder if people stop listening to the podcast when they get to the find us on Spotify, iTunes, whatever, like leave a rating and they just like stop the podcast then, or if they like listen to the rest and find out that like, oh, there's outtakes.
Yep. That's where the best stuff is.
Yeah, I know.
It probably depends how you listen, because mine are all queued up, so I don't, unless I know the podcast has really terrible, boring, like, outro stuff, I'm not going to fast forward to get to the next podcast. I just let it play out.
But maybe ours is really terrible and boring, Megan.
You put so much work into making it so funny.
That's after the boring stuff.
It's quick, we promise.
There's more and more of them, too. Like, I was listening to some of the earlier episodes, and there's not as much funny stuff at the end. And now you, like, really add it all in.
It's entirely dependent on how much funny stuff we actually said in an episode.
Yeah, there is that.
We've just gotten funnier.
There was one episode earlier this year where there was, like, one thing, and I'm like, oh, I guess we didn't say anything funny this week.
Very serious episode.
Or maybe there was even one that it just said nothing. I think it just faded out. I don't know. Mm. Also, there's been at least one where, like, I lost the funny stuff. And so I was just like, oh, no. Oh, okay. Like, I guess it's gone forever now.
It got gone off to misplaced podcast bits in the sky.
Yep. That it's Lucian's podcast library from Sandman.
Yeah.
All the books that were never written, all the podcasts never made.
Do we got any other stuff people want to talk about?
I can talk about my Christmas movies.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. And I have one more thing.
RJ, it's September.
Listen, it's always Christmas in somebody's heart.
In RJ's heart.
I've been watching these all year. I will say, well, okay, a few things about Christmas rom-coms. I mean, one, they're bad. I don't watch them because they're good movies. I watch them for other reasons. Two, I was for a little while, and I will probably pick it up again, working on designing a role-playing game that, like, took place in the world of a Christmas rom-com. Some of these movies were research.
That is the best reason.
That actually sounds like it could be a lot of fun to play, but only because I would be constantly bashing my character against the walls.
I think it would end up being a very tongue-in-cheek game.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You do not have to like these movies in order to play this game. I mean, I think there's been some fruitful bits of this quote-unquote research where I think, yeah, I haven't worked on it in a while, but there's going to be a mechanic. I'm breaking it up into, like, the acts of the film, and I feel like in the second or third act, there has to be a point where each player reveals whether or not they've been lying about their identity. And depending on, like, if one, neither, or both has been, like, there's different results. I haven't worked that out yet, but it happens so often in these movies that, like, someone's always lying about their identity.
RJ, my recommendation for that is that the character that is revealing that they're not who they are just rolls on a table right then to find out who their actual identity is.
I like that. Yeah, there's going to be a lot of tables for sure.
It's just, yeah, there's just like two or three tables. It's like, oh, no, I was not the, you know, whatever. It's like I was actually the I don't know the tropes for characters that appear in those things. So I can't make anything up.
They're a journalist or they're like, that's in the movies I'm about to talk about. Like the person is actually a journalist and she's masquerading as a tutor for the royal family of a made-up country.
Oh, those dystopian hellscape movies, yes.
Yes. Yeah, there's definitely going to be a table in the game, and I want it to be huge. I want to have like a 100-item table of whatever you're saving, you know, like save the rec center.
Oh, yeah.
The candy store. We're going to save, because there's always something in need of being saved. So yeah, for sure.
Please, you know, write in if you have suggestions for what RJ can put in this table of things to save in their holiday, their winter holiday RPG.
Please.
So yes, I've been watching a ton of these, some on my own, some with one of my friends, Mindy, who also gets the same enjoyment out of these bad Christmas rom-coms. The ones I'm going to talk about right now are the Christmas Prince trilogy, which is available on Netflix. So there's the Christmas Prince, the Christmas Prince, the Royal Wedding, and the Christmas Prince, the Royal Baby. I don't know why they're all called the Christmas Prince when he becomes king in the first movie. So there's no more princes after the first movie.
Rom-com logic. Just roll with it.
Well, I guess like they've got the trademark on that.
Yeah.
And they don't want to change it.
The thing about the Christmas Prince movies is they're all very bad. They're not the worst Christmas rom-coms I've seen. Christmas Wedding Planner is the worst one I've seen. Nine Lives of Christmas is the best one I've seen. But that one, even that one, is still very bad. But, you know, very enjoyable. Christmas Prince. So there's three of them. I'm sort of fascinated with them because they get both worse and better as they progress, which I think is just so unique and exciting. Like, by the time, like, I watched the first two and found myself, they were both so bad. And yeah, I found myself so excited to watch the third one. And it fulfilled everything I wanted out of it, which is that it was like very bad and silly. But they just like scaled up on like the cartoonishness, in a way that was satisfying, even though I could tell, you know, it's not a good movie. So the first one, the two main characters meet, they get together, blah, blah, blah. There's also this needless, like, National Treasure style mystery. Like, there's already the tension of, are these two characters going to get together? Is the main character's identity going to be revealed? And is the prince going to abdicate the throne? Already a lot of plot threads. And then also there is this weird twist where the prince is not the natural born son of the king. He was adopted, and I'm going to spoil the end of the Christmas Prince, but they find a royal decree inside of a Christmas ornament, that saves the day and solves the problem. But it was just such a needless, bewildering twist in that movie. The thing I like, though, is that like weird mystery, like scavenger hunt, puzzle solving element becomes more and more central in the following two movies, because they can't focus on the romance anymore because the characters are already together. So by the third movie, the mystery is so central to the plot that the heroine, she's pregnant, and it's the third act of the movie, so of course she is having contractions. Like, while she's having contractions, she finds enough time to like stand up and have the Sherlock style, someone in this room like committed the thing, and I'm going to unravel this right now. It's just deeply ludicrous and very funny. The third movie also had a curse in it. Like, if they didn't solve the mystery by midnight on Christmas Eve, her baby was going to be cursed.
For a second, I thought you meant like there was one swear word in the movie.
No, like a sorceress curse. Like,
yeah, that makes a lot more sense than like they say fuck.
they just say fuck in this one. Someone in this fucking room stole the peace treaty.
That's totally unbelievable. Can't go along with that.
So I don't know. I can't recommend these movies. But, you know, it's just the media that I've been consuming and enjoying, this month. I can't recommend them. They're not good. They do give you a lot to think about and talk about. Like, it's very fun for me to think about and talk about them, but they're not good movies.
Have you watched Jenny Nicholson's video about them?
I did, yes.
The Grim Dystopia of a Christmas Prince.
Yeah, one thing that she doesn't cover, because she makes the point that, like, there's a running theme of facade, and the main character, her father, appears in all three movies. And they changed the actor that plays her father between the first and second movie. And the actor they get in the second movie is much more like, she's from New York, and he's much more like, bada bing, New Yorkisms. And so, like, once I had watched them, I was like, she really missed highlighting that they, she has a much more fake-seeming dad now.
I kind of wish they just really leaned into that and just changed them every movie and yeah. just made the dad more and more like a New York stereotype every time.
The thing I love is the actor in the first movie, I looked him up because I was like, wait, this is a different guy, isn't it? The actor in the first movie who plays her like New York dad with his folksy wisdom, he's British. And I also think that is a missed opportunity for a great reveal where they kept that actor.
Yes.
It's not England. It's, you know, I don't even remember the name of the fake made up country. But Netflix has a whole fake made up universe. They have now have three distinct monarchies. Like they had a map in the third movie.
No.
Oh my God. Really?
Aldovia.
Yeah. Aldovia, yes.
The fact that Netflix has its own made-up rom-com universe makes me happy.
Oh, yeah. And they, like, refer to each other. And sometimes in some of the movies, they watch the other movies.
Oh, my God. I did not know this.
Yes. Oh, yes.
That's amazing.
In pretty much all of them now. I don't think it happens in Christmas Prince because it was one of the first ones. But there's definitely, like, any Netflix-produced rom-com, Christmas rom-com, that came out last year, or I think even the year before, the characters at some point will sit down and watch a different Netflix Christmas rom-com on a television.
Oh my gosh.
Whoever thought this up is a genius.
It's
definitely rewarding super fans.
I can't say anything because, like, I've read so many superhero comics that just make up countries and put them wherever.
Yeah, I'm so hoping that at some point, so they have all the rom-coms, but then they also have, what is the name of the Kurt Russell Santa Claus movie that filmed in Vancouver? I don't know what it is. It's a Christmas movie.
Snake Plissken, an escape from the North Pole? No, not that.
No, I don't think so. It is the Christmas Chronicles. Yes, sorry. Yeah, he plays this very tough guy Santa in Christmas Chronicles, this very Kurt Russell Santa. And what I want is, now that they have established this Christmas movie universe where all of these, like, places exist in the same world and are connected in some way, he just starts showing up. Kurt Russell Santa starts showing up at the end of these Netflix Christmas movies and recruiting the various characters to the Christmas Avengers.
Oh my gosh.
They have to save Christmas. Belgravia, I think, is the other one. That was in The Princess Switch, which was surprisingly good. I was mad that Princess Switch, like, emotionally moved me as much as it did. I was like, fuck this movie. I can't believe I care about this doofy-looking prince who's never wrapped a present before. Anyway. Anna, what's your last thing?
I can't follow that up. There's just no way. Nope. We're done. It's good.
Sorry. I should have known it was going to turn into a rant.
I'm sorry. Like, I'm looking at some maps of these, and, like, this world, this Europe, is, like, dramatically different from ours, from what I can tell.
Oh, yeah.
Like, clearly... It's not just like, here's this pocket nation that's like San Marino or Monaco. It's like, this is an actual country that exists in Europe for some reason. What? Who? Why?
Matthew, stop Googling right now. That is not the point.
Resist the rabbit hole.
All right. Do we want to do any last shout outs? Speed round shout outs before we're done? Or are we wrapped up?
I've mentioned it briefly before, but the Finish It podcast. I've been enjoying it a bunch. It's they co-hosted one of my visual novel streams with me last month. It is two brothers that are playing that read choose your own adventure novels, and each week they each do a read through, and they try to get every ending. They get eventually every ending of the book. So it's like a very slow meander through a choose your own adventure novel and that it will take them months to read one like 120 page book because they're really only reading like 5 pages a week at most. I think it's very entertaining.
They've got down how to do this.
If you are like weird completionist and are amused at choose your own adventure novels and masochistic reading, then you might also enjoy it. They started a new book relatively recently, so you can jump in at the first episode of it's like Undersea Adventure or something.
I'll briefly mention an audiobook. I actually listened to this like months, like right after the last time we did this. So it just barely missed the last deadline. It's called Do Nothing, How to Break Away from Overworking, Overdoing, and Underliving by Celeste Headlee. Headlee? I'm not sure. Sorry. And it's not like it's presenting anything like wildly new or revolutionary, but it's an excellent audiobook because Celeste Headlee is an NPR radio host and has the wonderful, reads it herself on the audiobook and has the wonderful NPR intonations. So it's very satisfying to have in your ears. And a lot of it is just like, it's essentially more about how the Industrial Revolution reshaped the way we work. And it's not the fault of our technology per se, but like it changed, that revolution changed the way we think about what work should or shouldn't be and how it should be in our lives. And it continues to play out despite the fact that work has changed wildly and is no longer, you know, like making things, but is thinking about things and how that can just expand into all of everything. But, you know, then breaks out like how that actually relates to her real life and things that she chose to change and try to do to get a handle on that. Anyways, it's just a satisfying read because NPR. Or, well, a satisfying listen, I guess, because NPR voice.
Oh, man, I got my mom hooked on Libby and audiobooks. And
yes.
One day, like, the verification didn't work. She was like, but how am I going to do my gardening if I can't listen to my audiobooks? And I was like, podcast? She was like, no.
That's great.
So I take it from that she doesn't listen to our podcast?
Nope.
Yeah, I'm into Libby as well. That is my preferred audiobook method. Not that I am not really an audiobook person all that much, so I'm incredibly slow at listening through audiobooks, but I have managed 3 so far this year, and I have like 2 others going, but I listen to them so slowly.
Well, it helps if you've got a commute.
Yeah, and yeah, I don't know. My commute right now is all Dig History podcast, so I'm not getting through my audiobooks because I'm all wrapped up in the Dig History podcast.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Book Club for Masochists. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Like, rate, subscribe, and leave a review, please.
For all our URLs and social media accounts, the 4 in our name is a numeral. You can go to our website at bookclub4m, join our Facebook group at facebook.com/group/bookclub4m, and find us on Twitter at bookclub4m or on Instagram at bookclub4m. Our email address is bookclub4m@gmail.com.
On our website, you can find show notes that will provide links to things that we mentioned and social media info for everyone who appeared on this episode.
You can also suggest a genre or title. We have a form you can fill out. No promises, though.
All opinions are our own and do not reflect our places of employment, if they exist.
Our theme music is To Arrakis by Dark Sun from the Free Music Archive. Who else is going to watch the new Dune movie? I am. Okay. Thank you.
There's a reason that's our music. It's because I knew Anna liked Dune and was searching for random book-related things. I'm not even joking.
New episodes are the 1st and 3rd Tuesday of every month.
Join us again on Tuesday, October 6th, when we'll be reading and discussing comedic or humorous novels, or comedic or humorous fiction, depending on what we end up reading.
Then on Tuesday, October 20th, we'll be playing Happy Birthday, Dracula, or something fun. We're going to do a fun thing.
Probably happy birthday, Dracula.
So, some of you may remember that we tried to do an RPG last year, I think. And due to technical difficulties, it did not happen. We're going to try again with a different Halloween and book-related thing. Something will happen. It should be fun? Question mark.
We're going to play games. It's going to be spooky. It's going to be fun.
I don't know if I can ever segue off anything Megan talks about, to be honest.
I'm going to try to talk loud because I'm further from my microphone because I have a cat in my lap now. Because the alternative is to have a cat screaming at me as I'm trying to record. So we'll see how this goes.
I really didn't need the, like, existential crisis comment in return to my simple question.
In a way that is, oop, sorry, oop.
Cat attack.
Just had a cat scramble.